Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Oil and gas leasing in the Badger 2 Medicine area, Montana's Medicaid and child health insurance programs, and we hear about preparations for the 2020 fire season. It's Wednesday, June 17th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Montana added another 5 cases yesterday to its count of lab-confirmed COVID-19 infections from more than 2,600 tests run by the state lab Monday. Bighorn County announced its 3rd death, a woman in her 30s who had been diagnosed and hospitalized. The state reports 60 active cases total, with 8 hospitalizations. Custer and Bighorn counties have the most active cases. As the busy summer season gets underway in various tourism hotspots around the state, the Blackfeet Nation bordering Glacier National Park is taking more time than the state of Montana to reopen the reservation to tourists due to concerns about COVID-19. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
For more than 25 years, Blackfeet tribal member Daryl Norman has set up dozens of teepees near his home on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, providing guests from all over the world with a unique place to stay while exploring neighboring Glacier National Park.
Hello!
Come in, let me get my mask.
Yep.
Come right in.
The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council approved a Phase 1 reopening plan June 4th. It has since been amended, according to a spokesperson for Blackfeet COVID-19 Incident Command, but the tribe has not published official details on its Phase 1 plan. Blackfeet Incident Command says a 14-day quarantine order and lodging restrictions for non-reservation residents remain in place. Sitting in his home gallery, full of traditional Blackfeet-style paintings and art, Norman says it's frustrating because it's unclear whether the tribe will extend those restrictions before they're set to expire June 30th.
Bookings are still coming in, and we can't give any. All we can say is we're closed through June. And then we doubt that we're not going to open the camp, teepee camp, after that. Cost. Whether, you know, just all the things considered, would probably be not the wisest thing to do.
Tribal leaders say the population here is vulnerable to COVID-19 and the restrictions have helped spare residents from the pandemic. While Norman hopes to salvage his season by mostly selling artwork, he understands the tribe's caution.
We don't want to be the ones who bring in the first case.
But tribal member Nathan St. Gador says local leaders aren't listening to the economic concerns of businesses like his. He owns Johnson's of St. Mary Restaurant and Campground, perched on a hill overlooking Glacier National Park's now closed east entrance.
I mean, our authority, you know, is the tribal council, and right now they want to stay closed. And I think it's really frustrating on our end is because I personally think that social distancing enforcement is more realistic than just total shutdown.
Tribal leaders and park officials say they are negotiating when the east gate of the park just outside of the reservation's boundary will open. St. Gador says if it doesn't open this year, he'll likely have to shutter the business his grandfather started 70 years ago.
Hey.
Good.
With things on the reservation at a standstill, communities on the west side of the park are welcoming back tourists. At the gate near West Glacier Friday, rangers let eager visitors know parking was limited.
It's just so busy, yeah. The head of the lake, Lake McDonald Lodge, parking filled up around 10 or 9:30 this morning, so pretty early, so yeah.
Tribally owned businesses say the tribe needs to either provide economic relief or to open back up to tourists in order for them to survive. Some are frustrated Blackfeet leaders haven't specified what it will take for the reservation to welcome visitors back without quarantine or testing requirements. Robert DeRozier is the Blackfeet Incident Commander.
It's a $1 million question, as far as I'm concerned. I can't predict the future, nor will I try. I can't tell you that we're going to open 5th of July, 6th of July, 4th of July. It's impossible for me to say that.
Glacier attracted 3 million people last year, who spent more than $100 million in Glacier County, which encompasses the Blackfeet Reservation. DeRozier says he understands the tribe's decisions are causing economic pain. but he says it's his job to look at this as an issue of protecting human life and not an economic crisis. With Montana Public Radio, I'm Aaron Bolton, reporting from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation.
A film made on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation and starring Miss Blackfeet has won a major award. Caitlin Nicholas reports.
Iniskum, a short film by Thunderheart Films, won an Emmy for its photography this month, in addition to being nominated for Best Historic Cultural Program and for Best Director.
When the buffalo was wiped out, they didn't just leave the land. They left us.
The film follows a young Blackfeet woman recovering from trauma as she goes on a buffalo drive. It was filmed in October 2016 and stars Aaliyah Heavyrunner, Miss Blackfeet. She was a junior in high school at the time. Working on Iniskum was her first time acting.
This is really hard. I don't show my emotions, like, always, don't cry. We gotta be strong and all that. They almost have to put onions into my eye because it was so hard.
Heavyrunner says that she wanted to make the film because she hoped to inspire her peers.
I just wanted to show my younger siblings, my younger cousin, and pretty much everybody on the reservation to tell them, hey, you know, if I can do it, you can do it too. Just because you're on a small reservation doesn't mean you can't do anything. The sky's the limit.
Director Daniel Glick says most of the scenes were improvised during an actual buffalo drive on the reservation. The narration was written later with the help of Blackfeet tribal members.
It was very much a collaborative effort. And then we got the music, and we were lucky enough to get music from Mike McCready, who's the guitarist from Pearl Jam. It was a really cool experience.
Glick and his crew, including producer Sarah Clark and photography director Zane Clampett, were inspired by the true story of a veteran who coped with his PTSD by going on a buffalo drive.
It's a fiction wrapped in kind of a documentary skin.
The Bozeman Film Festival will release Iniskum online on June 25th. Afterward, Thunderheart Films will publish the film on their website and social media for the public. Caitlin Nicholas, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Caitlin Nicholas is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Tribal Affairs reporter. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. ruled yesterday that a lower court was wrong to reinstate a contentious oil and gas lease in the Badger II Medicine area near the Blackfeet Indian Reservation and Glacier National Park. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The U.S. Interior Department in 2016 canceled the remaining oil and gas leases in the Badger II Medicine, which is the sacred homeland of the bordering Blackfeet Nation. Moncrief Oil and Solenex LLC took the Interior Department to court, arguing that the agency lacked the authority to cancel the leases decades after they were issued. The lower court didn't issue a decision on the agency's authority, but ruled its delay in granting permission to drill violated federal law and reinstated the leases. The latest appellate court ruling says the delay did not invalidate the Interior Department's decision to cancel all leases in the area and remanded the case back to the lower court. Peter Metcalf is the executive director of the Glacier II Medicine Alliance.
But by and large, this means that we're looking at an oil and gas-free Badger II Medicine for the first time since the early 80s, which is an amazing, amazing feeling.
Metcalf says it's unlikely for there to be any legal argument to reinstate the lease as Congress withdrew the Badger II Medicine from future oil and gas leasing in 2006. John Murray is the Blackfeet Tribe's historical preservation officer.
And for a while there, you know, I was a young man when I got involved. I was kind of wondering if I was going to see this day or not. It had gone on so long, but I am very, very happy.
Solenex became the last leaseholder in the Badger II Medicine last year when Moncrief Oil relinquished its holding after it came to a financial agreement with environmental groups. Mountain State's Legal Foundation attorney David McDonald, who represented the company, says he's disappointed with the ruling and says Solenex is exploring its options to challenge the decision. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Renewable energy industry advocates and Montana's Attorney General are among those pushing back on an East Coast group's petition that could put an end to the state's rooftop solar program for net metering. Kayla DeRoche reports.
The New England Ratepayers Association sent the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission a petition in April asking the agency to take control of electricity sale that's right now under state net metering rules. Industry advocates in Montana say that'd stop the state from overseeing its current net metering program. Montana Attorney General Tim Fox signed a letter along with 30 other state attorneys general opposing the proposal, saying individual states have the right to regulate the program. Net metering benefits customers with rooftop solar by taking extra energy from their panels, feeding it back into the electric grid, and compensating homeowners later in the form of credits on their utility bills. Andrew Valinas is executive director of the Montana Renewable Energy Association, which represents mostly small renewable businesses. The association joined around 450 other organizations from around the country this week in putting its name to a letter protesting the requested change to net metering regulations. Valinas says Montana's rooftop solar industry is small in terms of number of customers and employees.
All of a sudden, if they get a huge reduction in business, it's going to make it really, really challenging for them. Really challenging for them. So yeah, I think smaller markets are probably going to be hit a little harder, or smaller businesses are, you know, for sure. And that's what Montana's market is made up of.
Monday marked the deadline for comment on the proposal to federal regulators to shift net metering under their oversight. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Montana's health department is proposing a permanent ban on the sale of flavor vaping products in response to increasing youth e-cigarette use. The Department of Public Health and Human Services will take public comments on the proposed ban during a virtual hearing on July 16th and by mail, fax, and email. The department says it has the authority to adopt and enforce rules regarding public health issues. Nicole Ani is the program manager for the state-run tobacco use prevention program.
We are concerned about flavored e-cigarettes, so primarily because we are experiencing an epidemic of youth e-cigarette use in the nation and in Montana.
Owners of vape shops have said adults use the flavored products to help them quit smoking. A four-month ban on the sale of flavored e-cigarettes ended in mid-April. Deanna Marshall owns the Hamilton Freedom Vapes, which challenged the state health department's temporary ban on flavored vape products. Marshall says the agency cannot legally enact this rule, and she vows to openly defy it.
They don't have the authority to create laws that have criminal penalties.
Montana has historically ranked above the national average in youth vaping rates. Montana's health department distributed between $84 million and $163 million in Medicaid and Child Health Insurance Program benefits to people ineligible for those programs, according to an audit presented to lawmakers yesterday. Kevin Trevlin reports state officials emphatically reject several of the audit's key findings.
The report found there could be a corresponding hole in the state budget if the federal government tries to reclaim those payments, which came during a two-fiscal-year span ending June 2019. Alexa Odell with the Legislative Audit Division told an interim legislative committee that a federal report from January reinforces that possibility.
It does indicate that because of the increasing improper payment rates nationwide, that there may be a renewed focus on collecting those improper payments.
Most of the audit's flag costs came from the state Medicaid program. The state health department is taking issue with the Legislative Audit Division's methods for calculating Medicaid eligibility. Auditors used income tax data and assert they needed that information to verify case files and form meaningful conclusions. Meanwhile, State Department of Public Health and Human Services staff say auditors refused supporting evidence provided by the department. Out of 63 sample cases, auditors found about $216,000 in benefit payments to 26 ineligible Medicaid recipients due to income, household size, and other factors. Analyzing the same sample, the health department only found about $13,000 in benefits to 5 ineligible recipients. When other data was inadequate, Deputy Legislative Auditor Cindy Jorgensen said her staff divided annual tax records by 12 to determine whether monthly income supported Medicaid eligibility. However, Health Department Director Sheila Hogan said those calculations ignore dynamic financial circumstances that many Medicaid members face.
Think of people affected by the current pandemic. By no fault of their own, where would they be if the department only used stale income tax data used by the audit team to determine if they were eligible for health coverage.
Erica Johnston with the health department said they used 27 data points to determine Medicaid eligibility during the audit timeframe, but weren't legally permitted to use state income tax data. State Budget Director Tom Livers said the auditor's use of different records makes their subsequent report, quote, essentially useless, and that he could only think of one explanation to justify their choices.
The only one I can come up with to explain this process is that the division approached the audit with a predetermined conclusion that there's rampant ineligibility among Medicaid participants. And then they set out to prove the theory.
Livers said the chances of the federal government collecting ineligible Medicaid payments is, quote, remote at best. Kevin Trevlin, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Wildland fire managers told Governor Steve Bullock yesterday in a 2020 fire season briefing they're ready for what could become an above-average fire year made even more complicated by the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Nikki Ouellette reports.
Mike Dogroski with the State Department of Natural Resources and Conservation says even with 16 fires burning uncontained across Montana, fire season is still a few weeks away.
It's important for Montanans to remember that a normal fire season means that hundreds of wildfires are going to burn hundreds of thousands of acres. That's going to cost taxpayers tens of millions of dollars.
Dogroski joined fire managers from federal, tribal, state, and local agencies to brief Governor Steve Bullock about the 2020 fire season outlook. They're expecting a warm, dry summer, likely with more fire activity than last. With the new threat of COVID-19, managers this year are upping their reliance on initial attack to keep blazes small and squelch the need to call in more firefighters. But regional forester Leanne Martin with the U.S. Forest Service says she's aware they can't catch them all.
We will be moving forward, doing the best we can to keep them small, as you said. But we also understand that even with all things equal and everything going how we want it, just like this last weekend, the variables line up, we're going to have some large fires.
Agencies have staffed up and quarantined new hires. They've been trained in this year's new module as one approach, where small crews will segregate to limit the likelihood of transmitting illness. Managers say aerial and ground resources are in line with recent years, though resource sharing may take longer with COVID-19 precautions. The state has $55 million in its firefighting fund. Rich Cowger with the Montana State Fire Chiefs Association says the virus also presents longer-term concerns for the large swath of the state that relies on volunteer firefighters.
When you think about it, is people tend to volunteer when things are going really good in their lives. And with everything we got going on in the world today, that may be far from something.
That's right.
Managers hope to learn from successes and challenges elsewhere to be prepared as they can be when the season hits here in full. Dogroski with the DNRC adds the key this year is self-sufficiency, meaning not calling in out-of-state or even out-of-country firefighters to help shut down fires here. In Billings, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Pre-evacuation notices were lifted yesterday for some 20 homes threatened by the Lump Gulch fire burning south of Helena in Jefferson County. Strong winds caused the fire to grow quickly, and John Tubbs, director of the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, says he does not know how those homes were spared.
I don't quite know how this fire found its way to burn what it burned, 1,500 acres, and not burn through a subdivision.
The fire was downsized to 1,100 acres Monday due to better mapping. 135 fire personnel are assigned to the fire from a variety of organizations, including the DNRC and the U.S. Forest Service. The Lump Gulch fire is 25% contained and so far has cost $350,000 to fight. The cause is still under investigation. Over in southeast Montana, firefighters are working to protect 10 structures, including a residence and ranch buildings, from the Fire Gulch fire burning in Powder River County. Sage grouse habitat is also threatened by the nearly 1,300-acre fire burning in timber, brush, and tall grass 16 miles southwest of Ashland. The lightning-caused fire was first reported on Monday on private land and was 30% contained yesterday morning. Some 28 personnel are currently combating the wildfire that's cost $35,000 to date. 400 fires have been reported in Montana this year, according to DNRC. 16 fires are uncontained. Montana is predicted to have an above-average wildfire season, and with firefighters potentially facing dual emergencies of wildfire and COVID-19, specialists say this year, more than any other, residents can play a vital role in keeping firefighters safe by preparing their homes and communities. Morgan Levy takes us on a wildfire assessment of her home.
It's a warm evening in late May, and I'm looking at the ponderosa pine and Douglas fir forests of Mount Jumbo looming overhead. I'm in front of my house in Missoula's Upper Rattlesnake neighborhood, and I'm out here using Zoom on my phone to take a tour of my yard with Chris Johnson.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, and I can see you just great too.
Every year, the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation offers free home visits by local fire professionals to residents who live in and near the wildland-urban interface, the junction where houses and forests meet. The goal is to make properties less vulnerable to wildfires, and they're still doing it this year, just virtually.
I would say, thing I would tell a homeowner, whether I'm walking with you virtually or walking with you around the home, that your responsibility to lessen the risk of your home to wildfire is yours.
Chris Johnson is part of an interagency wildfire prevention and education team for Southwest Montana. We spent an hour on Zoom as I walked around my property, looking at everything from my roof to the painted surface of the walls to that ignored corner of the yard where debris has piled up. He asked me questions like,
how far away from the slope are you? Any place where vegetation other than green grass is touching the home? Any other storage around the house?
To guide us, Johnson was using a 15-page checklist, one of several resources in the virtual toolkit put together by the DNRC. During shelter-in-place, homeowners were encouraged to use the materials to evaluate their homes.
I think more than any other year, it's important for Montanans to take action this year.
Kristen Sleeper is the state's Community Preparedness Program Manager for the DNRC. She says that like any other year, the goal is to protect communities and Montana's natural resources from fire. But she adds this year, with firefighters needing to isolate themselves into small crews, any wildfire will increase their interaction with other people and their exposure to COVID-19.
We want to make sure we're doing everything we can to reduce the risk of firefighter exposure. So we've really sort of redoubled down on our efforts to educate Montanans about what they can do and the impact that they can have in doing their part to keep wildfires from starting.
Nearly 64% of Montana residents live in the wildland-urban interface, according to a 2018 report conducted by Silvis Lab out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And in reality, it's probably a larger percent, as the report used data from 2010. Sleeper says during shelter-in-place, the DNRC tried to capitalize on their captive audience.
What I would say right now, we're having more homeowners reach out to us because they have either been contacted by their insurance company and need a wildfire home assessment, but also they just simply have more time and they've been more engaged in different aspects. So we've tried to really be proactive in doing a lot of interviews and talking to a lot of people to make sure they know we still have digital resources available.
This also means ramping up social media efforts in place of in-person meetings to educate communities. But fire prevention specialists in Southeast Montana say it can be difficult to know if their virtual messaging is landing. The story is similar in the Northwest. Allie Allwelling works in the DNRC's office in Kalispell. They've been issuing press releases to the communities in Northwest Montana,
recommending that homeowners in the wildland-urban interface do take a little extra time this season, understanding that our wildland fire resources are going to be operating in a different way.
The DNRC supports pile burning around properties and activities that mitigate potential wildfire fuel, because the goal is to avoid putting unnecessary stress on potentially limited firefighting resources. They also warn residents to be mindful that debris burns don't get out of control. In Montana, 60% of wildfires are human-caused, and specialists say it's imperative to minimize any preventable incidents this year. Another aspect of fire season preparation is wildland fuel mitigation, activities like thinning trees or burning debris in overgrown forests to reduce the likelihood of a high-intensity fire later in the season. Mike Gokachia works in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest. He says due to COVID-19, the Forest Service had to take precautions around adding extra smoke to the atmosphere this spring. They actually stopped prescribed burns for a period of time.
Because it's a respiratory illness, my agency took that approach across the country. The generalized big broadcast burns that you would normally see going on, people have held off on that.
According to Gokachia, prescribed burns have now continued in the Northern Rockies.
sprinkler on those problematic spots.
Back to my home assessment. We spent a lot of time looking at the home ignition zone, the 30-foot area that is most likely to cause my house to catch fire. Apart from a wood fence butting up against the garage, I was mostly in the clear.
Okay, the last thing I want to check is out on the street. What we want to make sure of here is, would somebody know they've arrived at your address?
You cannot see my house number from the street. This is what the fire department will use to identify a house. I failed this one. But luckily, after our call, Johnson will send me a full report of his assessment so I can fix the problem areas before fire season. For information on how to book a home assessment, visit our website or contact your local DNRC land office. In Missoula, I'm Morgan Levy for Yellowstone Public Radio News.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.